Welcome to OncoPharm. I'm your host, John Bazar. I'm the professor of pharmacy practice here at the supporting sponsor of OncoPharm, ETSU's Bill Gadd College of Pharmacy. It is the first day of the Masters Tournament here in early April 2024. I am back from the HOPA annual conference and refreshed, and have a couple things that I learned that I found interesting from the programming over the conference, as well as some other pertinent updates to pass along. So first, I want to talk about kind of the big picture update in neuro-oncology. During my residency, my longitudinal clinic was a neuro-oncology clinic, so I got pretty good at reading MRIs, which is not that hard because there's a left side and a right side that should be mirror images. Not helpful, though, as a pharmacist. But what I had kind of not stayed current with is that the World Health Organization, WHO, changed their classifications for how they diagnose and categorize gliomas, or primary CNS tumors. And now I'm not a diagnostician, so why should I care as a pharmacist? Well, it seems, and this was a great talk by Kelly Fritz at Huntsman Cancer Center at the University of Utah. It kind of upends a lot of what the pivotal studies that we talk about. So, for example, it used to be if you had a grade 4 glioma, it was called glioblastoma multiforme, grade 4 GBM. And they weren't looking for any sort of mutations or anything like that in the DNA. And this has, been the paradigm shift in oncology for the last 10 to 15 years, is not just morphology, what we used to do, but now morphology and cytogenetics and genomics of the tumor. That's why we don't talk about the French, American, British, or FAB classification system for AMLs anymore. Used to spend a lot of time on that 10 to 15 years ago on rounds. So it used to be grade 4, very aggressive glioma was a GBM. Now, if it's grade 4, but it's IDH mutated, it's no longer classified as a glioblastoma multiforme GBM. It's a grade 4 astrocytoma. And the reason that's important is, for GBMs, our big landmark paper that I think I've done an episode on is this STUP paper from 2005 in New England Journal of Medicine, where they get radiation or adjuvant temozolol, or randomized to either radiation or concurrent radiation and temozolomide followed by adjuvant temozolomide for 6 cycles. So in that study, most of the benefit was derived from those that hit MGMT methylated status on their tumor. So those folks, were not able to repair DNA damage in the tumor from the alkaline agent temozolomide, and therefore the cancer cells died. So that was the big predictor. Well, a lot of the IDH1 mutated grade 4 tumors are hypermethylated. Those folks would not be classified as GBMs anymore. So if you redid that study now, the exact same way, radiation or radiation plus Temodar, the makeup of that group is probably going to have a lot less MGMT methylated because you're taking out all this IDH1 mutant population, and a lot of those are going to be methylated. So it really kind of calls into question the benefit of temozolomide in those folks that are what we would diagnose today as GBM without that IDH1 mutation. And so there's a new field of study called methylomics, which is the study of methylation patterns that might help, better define some tumor, some gliomas, and who gets diagnosed. So that was a really interesting thing to learn that kind of blew my mind, to be honest with you. And it makes us question stuff that has been dogma for years, because as things evolve, science changes. And this, in non-oncology news, there was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think it was called the Reduce AMI study, that looked at folks after a heart attack and looked at, was there benefit from a beta blocker? And there wasn't. And the rationale, and beta blockers have been a mainstay of post-MI care for years. I remember I was prepping for an episode of this podcast years ago, and I went to the library, the medical library, and I'm getting in this edition of the New England Journal of Medicine, the late 70s or 80s, because it's not available electronically. As I'm trying to find whatever it is I'm trying to find, I see an advertisement for Inderol, which is propranolol. And it wasn't a Kaplan-Meier curve, because I don't think Kaplan-Meier curves have been invented, but it was an overall survival curves of propranolol versus placebo, demonstrating that propranolol, of all beta blockers, had benefit in post-MI. But back then, in the 70s, 80s, we didn't have high-dose statins. Oh, the mowers are here. We didn't have high-dose statins. We didn't have ACE inhibitors and ARBs We did not have PCI and available to everyone. We didn't have drug-eluting stents. So it's a different era now. So it makes sense to redo that study. Same thing that we're seeing in gliomas, and the same thing will happen with other cancers as well. So as our knowledge and of the biology of the cancer evolves, so must we update our studies. So anyway, that was a great talk. Another great talk was the updates in hematology by Dennis Marjankou. I think I'm saying that correctly. And I think I'd mentioned this on the podcast. Maybe I didn't, or if I did, I completely forgot about this, that fedratinib, this JAK2 and FLT3 inhibitor that's approved for myelofibrosis, caused some Wernicke encephalopathy in some folks. And like, that's kind of a big deal. So you have to check their thiamine levels, replace it before you start it, and check thiamine periodically, and maybe supplement with thiamine. And so I was like, what is the mechanism behind this? And found some study that that linked it to a thiamine transporter, that it blocked that thiamine transporter. And then some other scientists said, well, the way that study was done was not actually indicative of thiamine transport in humans at normal or at like the concentrations you would expect of fedratinib. So they redid it and didn't show it, but it has something probably to do with thiamine absorption. It doesn't happen in everybody either. When I think about side effects of drugs, if you get high dose of cytarabine, everyone's going to have myelosuppression. It's not dependent on, there's not a lot of interpatient variability. You're all going to have myelosuppression, right, if you get high-dose cytarabine. Not everyone got encephalopathy with fedratinib, which makes me think that some folks have a mutation to maybe that thiamine transporter. That would kind of be my hypothesis. So some other quick-hitting things from HOPA. We don't see a ton of Hodgkin's patients, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the ones we do, we cure. So we don't see a lot of relapsed refractory Hodgkin's. So I was unaware, but this makes sense, that we're now combining immune checkpoint inhibitors like pembrolizumab and nivolumab with some of our traditional or historical bridging chemotherapy regimens. Like there's a nivolumab ICE, I think, and pembro and some stuff. So, that makes sense. There was a talk that was, honestly, it was a foreign language to me about cost versus margin. And there's this thing called 505b2 generics that sound important. I didn't quite understand, again, because the financial part of it, I'm not very well versed in. Another great talk was by a former student, Brooke Adams, talking about bispecific antibodies in multiple myeloma. And the one thing that kind of stood out, besides how wonderful that talk was that for these bispecifics, the more, plasma cell, blast percentage in the bone marrow, the lower the response rate you see with these drugs, which makes sense. Higher disease burden, the lower the response rate, but good to see that. I had a similar question come to me on rounds a week before that I wasn't sure how to answer, but better able to answer that now after her talk. Okay, HOPA, great conference, a lot of great networking, a lot of fun, really a lot of great people in that organization. So big fan of HOPA. Okay. While HOPA was going on, there were a couple, FDA approvals or expanded indications in the last couple weeks I haven't talked about. I think the biggest one, and the only one I'll talk about today, is the site-agnostic approval for FAM-trastuzumab deruxtecan for HER2-positive, we'll say HER2-amplified or HER2-overexpressed. So this is trastuzumab deruxtecan is already approved for breast cancer that's HER2 positive or amplified and HER2 low. It's approved for gastric cancer that's HER2 amplified, and then previously approved for non-small cell lung cancer with a HER2 activating mutation, not HER2 overexpression, not IHC, but a mutation in HER2. So this is for anyone with any solid tumor that is out of treatment options, is this approval. It's an accelerated approval. It's just based on response rate. I'm going to go through some of the cancers here and the numbers, because it's a relatively small sample size within each disease kind of group. So for colorectal cancer, the N was 64 patients. Combined response rate was 47%, pretty solid. Bladder cancer, 27 patients, 37% response rate. Cholangiocarcinoma, tough to treat, 22 patients, 46%. Non-small cell lung cancer, 17 folks with HER2 amplification, response rate of 53%. Ovarian cancer, 15 patients, 67%. Now here's where we're gonna pause, because then cervical cancer, there were 10 patients with a 70% response rate. There's probably some some enrichment of people with very, very high expression of HER2 in these studies. You know, the 95% confidence intervals on all these on these tests are pretty wide, especially as the N goes down within each disease state. So in the real world, I would love to believe, I would love for it to be true that 70% of cervical cancer patients will respond to this drug if they're HER2 amplified. There are only 10 patients in that cohort. So if I were a betting person, I'd bet that it's less than 70% because that would just be outstanding if you expand it to anyone with HER2 overexpression using this kind of the standard definition we use for breast cancer. But word of caution, 5 pancreatic cancer patients, 0% response rate. So, but certainly is going to expand, you know, what we should be thinking about for these patients when you see them in clinic or they come to the hospital for disease progression or symptoms of disease progression is, you know, do we have, you know, do we have that that HER2 that's pretty easy to do, actually, locally on these things to see if they have another therapy option. But again, it's accelerated approval, whether or not this therapy option, despite having, you know, good response rates, has an efficacious and safe toxicity profile in the long run compared to something else. Remains to be seen, accelerated approval. And then the last big thing I'll talk about is the ALINA study, A-L-I-N-A, published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is adjuvant alectinib in non-small cell lung cancer. This is a similar, although not exact, design that's analogous to ADAURA, which was adjuvant osimertinib for EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. So these folks were stage, I think, 1B to 3A, had surgery, usually most of the case lobectomy, and then they're randomized to 2 years of alectinib, or 4 cycles of cisplatin-based chemotherapy. Now, the way that differs from ADAURA is in ADAURA, everyone got chemo and then osimertinib, or then placebo, and then they got osimertinib for 3 years versus this is 2 years of alectinib. You know, there's a sizable disease-free survival benefit of alectinib versus chemotherapy, not surprising. There's a sizable CNS-free, disease-free survival benefit as well. 4 deaths in the chemo arm, 2 deaths in the alectinib arm, way too early to see about disease recurrence or about overall survival. So, you know, in the long run, the big question is going to be the folks that get chemo, do they live just as long because they have access to, you know, they're ALK inhibitor naive when and if they do have relapse disease? And then the folks on alectinib after 2 years, could you restart alectinib if they recur 3 years later? If they recur pretty quickly, you probably would go to a newer generation ALK inhibitor like lorlatinib. But that question remains to be seen. But I would imagine that this will be adopted by most folks as standard of care for these ALK patients. So if you're not, it's probably time to start, you know, if you're just looking for EGFR on your localized disease, which you're probably not, you ought to be looking for ALK too for those folks with non-small cell lung cancer. So those are the updates I have from HOPA and the larger HEMONC world. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on the app formerly known as Twitter at PharmDNIB, and can follow the podcast on both X, Threads, and Instagram at OncoPharmPod. And until I talk to you again, remember, doses matter. Thank you.